The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the February 2025 Walter Magazine. We begin with Kindred Spirits. Aaliyah Bonnett explores her deep connection to her family through quilts and paint, by Colony Little. For many quilters, the craft is passed down through generations. Children sit with their mothers, aunties, and grandmothers, learning to stitch strips of fabric together through time-honored traditions. For Raleigh-based mixed-media artist Aaliyah Bonnett, her unique quilting practice was self-taught, and it led her back to an ancestral muse. As a child growing up in Baltimore, Bonnett was drawn to garment and textile design, fascinated with competition shows like Project Runway. But her fantasy of becoming a fashion designer began and ended around 9 years old, when she found that threading bobbins on the sewing machine was a bit too troublesome. Years later, while living in North Carolina, new creative pursuits caught her eye and her imagination. I had just moved from Maryland to Garner and joined an art club with some new friends, she says. Painting figures was something that I started almost immediately. The form, skin tones, and emotions you can achieve while painting figures drew me to figurative works. When Bonnett enrolled at East Carolina University, she originally planned to become an art teacher. I was focused on teaching K through 12, she says, but I had a professor, who I'm still close with to this day, who pulled me aside and said, "You need to do studio art." During this time, Bonnett took an African-American studies course where she learned about how quilts and their intricate patterns were believed to have been used as communication devices to guide escaped slaves to freedom through the Underground Railroad. That inspired her to include quilting in her own artistic practice. Her first painted quilt combined four traditional quilt blocks with five painted blocks and text in a trenchant commentary on the legacy of slavery in the United States. She graduated in 2021 with a dual concentration in textiles and painting alongside a minor in African American studies. When Bonnett went home to Raleigh to retrieve the sewing machine she'd shelved as a kid, her mother encouraged her to call her grandfather, whose late wife, Aaliyah's grandmother, Sarah, was also a quilter. He said, "I still have all her fabric and quilts. Everything is still in my basement." He was a little hoarder, Bonnett laughs. We always joked that if the apocalypse happened, it was his house that we were going to. This discovery inspired an impromptu road trip to her grandfather's home in Atlanta, where he rolled out three large rusted barrels of quilts, many of which were unfinished, along with bolts of fabric. He told me he'd go to the end of the bolt sales at JCPenney in the 1960s and 70s and buy barrels of fabric for my grandma to quilt with, says Bonnett. This trove of material became a source of inspiration for Bonnett. She found that the communicative properties of making quilts felt just as fortuitous as the fabric itself. With every stitch and seam, Bonnett felt a growing spiritual connection to her grandmother. It felt like a chance to know her in a way that nobody else had thought of. All these quilts were just sitting there for over 20 years, she says. Over the next 3 months, Bonnett completed a few of her grandmother's unfinished quilts and gave them to members of her family. Then, inspired by multimedia artists like Faith Ringgold, Derek Adams, and Basil Kincaid, who used painting, text, and textiles to celebrate contemporary Black life, Bonnet experimented further by fusing her figurative painting with this new source of deeply personal material. Lately, Bonnet has been exploring different representations of her kindred, a word she uses to describe her ancestral ties, depicting them as mysterious beings wearing pink ski masks. She debuted a series of works from this collection in a 2024 solo show at ArtSpace titled Onslaught. The title refers to an idea she has of a legion of spiritual guardians that protects the subjects in her quilts. Through their work, many artists attempt to construct the realities they want to inhabit. And for Bonnet, her art is a form of storytelling that is both self-deterministic and fantastical. I'm tapping into this idea of how I would want my ancestors to protect me, thinking about how I want them alongside me through things that I'm going through that are extremely personal, she says. Part of that journey is Bonnet grappling with the deaths of both of her grandfathers within the last year. I think of them while I'm making this work. In my head, they've become part of my onslaught, says Bonnet. In December, she moved out of her ArtSpace studio, opting to work at home as she explores new work, not necessarily in textiles, based on the onslaught idea. I'm printmaking, working on an artist's book. I want to give myself the opportunity to experiment. This article was edited for Time. Next up, Vanishing from View. Photographer Scott Sharp captures North Carolina's rural communities by Anne Monique Clark. Over the last 2 years, Scott Sharp, the director of multimedia and photography at the News and Observer, has been working on a side project called All But Forgotten North Carolina. Part art, part journalism, it's a photographic ode to North Carolina's farming and small-town communities. The old rural landscape is disappearing very quickly, he says. I used to drive all around the state as a photographer, always in a hurry. I'd see things and think, I'll take a picture the next time I'm there. But when I'd go back, it'd be gone. The project has roots in a weekly photo feature called Tar Heel Scenes that ran in the NNO starting in the mid-1980s, when Sharp was a staff photographer. The feature has long since been discontinued, but a few years ago, Sharp was on assignment for a story about chicken farming and had a couple hours to kill. I drove around and made a few frames. That lit the fire, Sharp says. Since then, he estimates that he's probably taken 1,000 to 2,000 photos, showcasing many of them on his Instagram account, All But Forgotten NC. I don't shoot a lot of photos in each spot. The more I shoot, the more time I'll have to spend editing, and that gets to be work, he says. This is meant to be my escape from work. Sharp is influenced by the Works Progress Administration photographers of the 1930s and 40s, whose simple compositions gave an honest account of daily life. Similarly, the places I photograph were hard places to live, harder than most of us can imagine. There are very few degrees of separation between the times of slavery and Jim Crow and sharecropping, between cotton and tobacco, he says. I never want to be perceived as romanticizing places built on this horrible history, and I never want to make light of where somebody lives. To take his photos, Sharp often sets out on a Sunday morning when there's less traffic. Plus, nobody's hunting on Sunday mornings, he says. He'll start driving with a place in mind, always using a paper map as his guide. Often, I never get there. I'll wonder what's down one road, or miss a turn and find a beautiful situation, he says. Texture and light are the two things I see first. Old wood, paint, rust. Then I'll see how a structure fits into the landscape and how the background adds to the scene. A drawback of this wandering approach is that Sharp often can't remember exactly where he took the photo. But that's okay, too, he says. There's a tremendous amount of vandalism and architectural theft that happens in these old buildings, and I don't want to share enough information to promote that. Through his photographs, Sharp hopes that folks will remember North Carolina's history and agricultural roots. None of these places are more than 2 hours from Raleigh. It's amazing how different the world is, even in eastern Wake County, he says. The past is right next door. Next, from the Nature Department, Ghost of the Woods, recalling precious run-ins with North Carolina's only wild feline, the bobcat, by Mike Dunn. Elusive, secretive, solitary, these are all words that describe one of my favorite mammals, the bobcat, Lynx rufus. Over the years, I've had fewer than 20 encounters with these masters of stealth, but each one is embedded in my memory as a treasured experience. Bobcats are found throughout our state, but are more common in the mountains and coastal plain. Most of my sightings have been at wildlife refuges in eastern North Carolina. One that particularly stands out was back in 2005 at my favorite refuge, the Pungo Unit of Pocosin Lakes National Wildlife Refuge near Plymouth. Driving on a dirt road on the refuge, I spotted an animal several hundred yards in the distance and stopped to look through my binoculars. It was a red wolf. The wolf was trotting down the left side of the road, moving away from me. Suddenly, the wolf stopped and moved over to the other side of the road, tail tucked, glancing back. I saw something in the grass off to the left, but wasn't sure what it was. Then it arched its back, and I could see a bobcat staring at the wolf. When the wolf got beyond the wildcat, it looked back and trotted quickly down the road. The bobcat relaxed and moved on across the road, disappearing into the brush. Despite being well over twice the size of the bobcat, the wolf apparently had no interest in tangling with this fierce feline. Bobcats are North Carolina's only wild cat. They're twice as large as a domestic house cat, standing about 2 feet high at the shoulder and weighing from 15 to 40 pounds, with males being larger than females. Their fur is brownish to gray, with white undersides and dark bars or spots. Bobcats are so named because of their short, bobbed tails, about 5 inches long. The underside of the tail is white, and they have distinctive white spots on the back of their ears. Those spots are thought to resemble false eyes to deter predators, and they may also help kittens see and follow their mothers in low light. Bobcats are opportunistic feeders and will take advantage of almost any available prey. Twice over the years, I've seen bobcats with waterfowl. One was at sunrise, carrying a dead snow goose through a field at Pungo. When we stopped the car to watch, the cat dropped its meal, and we felt bad about that, and crawled on its belly, almost like a snake, until it reached a ditch. It got into the water, crossed the ditch, into a line of trees, and disappeared. On another winter visit to the refuge, when waterfowl are abundant in the fields feeding on waste grains and winter wheat, I saw a tundra swan flopping on the ground a few hundred yards away. A small group of swans stood nearby, necks stretched in an alert pose. With binoculars, I saw a bobcat hanging onto the swan by the neck, while the large bird, weighing up to 20 pounds, struggled to escape. The swan eventually did pull away and flew off, but I could see blood on its neck. The bobcat retreated to the ditch, from where it, no doubt, had ambushed the feeding bird and disappeared. Such is the usual encounter with bobcats. A brief view, often in poor lighting or hidden by brush, making it difficult to clearly observe or photograph. That's why any time you get even a few minutes with one of these beautiful creatures out in the open, it's especially meaningful. I've been lucky to have had two such experiences. One day, while driving the roads at Pungo, I spotted a bear across the canal, sitting at the edge of the water. I had to drive past and turn around to get it on my side of the car to photograph. After a few photos, the bear stood up and wandered back into the woods. I started to back up to turn around, and when I looked in my rearview mirror, there was a large bobcat coming out of the woods behind me. It stopped for a few seconds, looked at me, and then slowly walked down the road. I finished turning my car around and slowly followed the big cat. It must have been a large male, for about 50 yards before it headed back into the roadside tangle of bushes and vines. My favorite bobcat incident happened late one hot September day about a decade ago. Once again, my wife and I were driving on a dirt road in a part of Pocosin Lakes National Wildlife Refuge that's rarely visited by the public. We turned a corner and spotted something far down the road, but we couldn't quite tell what it was since it was walking away from us. When it turned, we could see it wasn't a deer, no long neck, and not a coyote or wolf. It had a short tail. It was a bobcat. We drove slowly towards it and it walked off the road into the vegetation. I've read that bobcats and many other animals will sit quietly while you drive or walk by and then come out and resume their travel after you pass. So we drove slowly, hoping to see it sitting in the bushes. We didn't, but then went well beyond where the cat had disappeared. We parked in the shade of a lone pine tree and got out. We sat against the back of the car so as to minimize our human forms and waited. In just a couple of minutes, the bobcat came back out into the road and continued walking our way. At one point, it stopped, slowly crept to the side of the road, and pounced. It stayed hidden in the grasses for a minute or so, presumably gulping down whatever small creature it had caught, then heading toward us again. We were taking photos and watching intently as the cat approached, stopped, and to our surprise and delight, sat down in the middle of the road. It just stared at us with a sleepy look, occasionally turning its head to look around. It sat there for a few minutes and then slowly got up and walked to the side of the road, turned, and vanished. Melissa wanted to get up right away and see how close it had been. I suggested we wait, as it might just come back out. Many minutes went by without any hint of its presence, so she got up and paced off how close it had been to us when sitting in front of us. As she got to where it had walked off the road, it suddenly bolted from its hidden spot in the bushes and ran farther back into the shrub thicket. All we saw was moving vegetation as it evaporated deeper into the thick Pocosin vegetation. It had stopped and may have just been watching us all that time without us being able to see it. Turns out it was only about 30 feet from us. In all, we spent a little over 15 minutes with this beautiful ghost of the woods. Magical moments like this are why we spend time outdoors and why we so appreciate our public lands and other wild places. This article was edited for Time. From the Our Town section, Walk with History by Addie Ladner. It has taken me almost a lifetime to discover that true emancipation lies in the acceptance of the whole past, in deriving my strength from all my roots, in facing up to the degradation as well as the dignity of my ancestors. That's a quote by the late Pauli Murray, a priest, attorney, and civil rights leader. Murray's words are etched in the stone walls at Freedom Park, 218 North Wilmington Street, one of several public tributes to Black history in our city. A few miles away is Oberlin Rising at 809 Oberlin Road, a cluster of earth-cast columns by Raleigh artist Thomas Sayre that nods to the nearby historic Black neighborhood of Oberlin Village. Further south, at 1215 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in East Raleigh, is a life-size sculpture of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. near a fountain inscribed with his words. Built in 1957, it was the country's first public park devoted to the legend. From the endnote, eating on the job. This method of commercial pruning is both effective and adorable, by Addie Ladner. Stephen Paul has just under 100 hardworking employees. They eat all day, sometimes nap on the job, wander around, and distract passersby. Bernie might be his MVP. A friendly fellow who likes chin rubs and has a big personality. Paul owns Goats on the Go, Raleigh Durham, a company that offers a fairly new form of sustainable agribusiness here in the Triangle. If folks have a lot that's deeply overgrown, property owners can rent a herd of stealthy, motivated ruminants to clear the land. That employee, Bernie, he's a Saanen dairy goat. Paul says there are many perks to using goats on projects like these. We don't use chemical herbicides, and goats are good at getting to areas that a machine or human might not be able to reach. Goats can navigate tricky terrain, steep slopes, and small nooks, and because they digest most everything down to the nub, they don't spread seeds or roots to other parts of a landscape. Another perk? They're cute. Anne and Wade Smith are among Paul's Raleigh clients. Last July, They used Goats on the Go to clear a lot they own near Hayes Barton. It's kept natural for their tight-knit neighborhood to enjoy the wildlife and trees and hold social gatherings, but it had gotten too overgrown. Paul set up around 20 goats armed with GPS trackers and virtual electric fencing to keep them contained, and they stayed for a week, much to the delight of the neighbors. We've hosted Halloween parties here for more than 50 years, but this was the best event we've ever had, says Anne. Anne says they even got to know the goats' idiosyncrasies. For example, they love poison ivy. They think it's candy, but will only eat English ivy if nothing else is there, she says. Since goats will consume most anything, Paul says that probably the biggest challenge of running his animal husbandry business is learning which plants the goats can't tolerate. Our greatest threat to the health of the herd is them eating a plant we missed, he says. Daffodils and azaleas are poisonous to goats. And for this project, Paul had to remove some nandina, whose berries are highly toxic to the animals. Neighbors of all ages enjoyed watching the goats work. They bring joy, and we need more joy, says Anne. Her husband Wade agreed. They worked hard and with good cheer. From the calendar, in observation of Black History Month, Dorothea Dix Park joined Raleigh Film and Arts Festival to present the 2025 Living in Color Artist Exhibit. The exhibition features a curated collection of works from both professional and student artists, all exploring the experience of people of color in the South. The exhibit is open to the public, free of charge, through February 28th. The exhibit is at 1030 Richardson Drive, or on the web, go to dixpark.org for more information. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.